You're listening to The Doug Haldeman Show on FM News Talk 97.1.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Doug Haldeman. I'm here with my good friend, Bill Bayer from Lighthouse Growth Resources, your business consultant and an economist, as well as a mentor of mine. So I appreciate you coming back on the show.
Glad to be here.
So we were just talking about housing, and you know, we've watched these McMansions spring up over the last 15 to 20 years. And when you look at the square footage in the 1980s versus the square footage now, people are just building bigger homes. Although that trend does seem to be reversing some, what do you think caused that dynamic?
Well, let's go back to a little bit of history. And I came in the housing market in the late 70s. My wife and I bought our first house in 1980, in the midst of the just after Reagan was elected, and he had run on the misery index, which was a combination of inflation and interest rates, which were in the 20s at that time. My first mortgage had a 12% mortgage rate, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because we could actually buy a house.
Yeah, that was cheap compared to the 18 to 20%.
Absolutely. And what happened over the starting roughly and within a couple of years of that up until 2005, there were two major trends that I believe drove the change in the housing market. The first one of those was that for the first time, people started looking at a house as something where you can grow your wealth and store your wealth. When I was at Citicorp in the 80s, I was insanely jealous of people who would relocate because the company paid all the expenses of the relocation. And they would move to California, buy a bigger house, move 2 years later and double their money and come back to St. Louis and buy a house that was big enough to basically take up my entire neighborhood. And as that was repeating itself, one of the things that changed from what my dad and his generation viewed housing is they viewed housing as a place to live. The goal is to pay it off, get rid of your mortgage payment, make sure that when you got older you didn't have to pay anybody. And in my lifetime, housing up until the recession, the Great Recession in 2007, 2008, became something where people looked at housing more as an investment. The second piece of the equation was from the mid-70s up until 2008, the percentage of women that were working went from about 25% to about 75%. So two things came out of that. First of all, even if the woman was in a job that didn't pay nearly as much as the husband, in general, that family's income went up by somewhere between 30 and 50%.
Right.
It also
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And you know, when I was growing up, my mom probably about every 2 years would tell my dad she wanted to move. He'd say, we can't afford it, and that was the end of the conversation. When right. You get into the 80s and 90s and on, where a woman is bringing a significant amount of money, she has a bigger say in that conversation. She's contributing that. They have more disposable income, and they're able to go out and buy a house. And when they go buy, they can buy a bigger house. So right. When you couple those two factors together, that, I think, is what drove the housing market. Both of those things have changed. My kids, I have three kids in their 20s and 30s. Their attitudes about housing are totally different than mine were. They do not look at it as something where they're going to make money. They look at getting an initial home and then buying another home that they can live in essentially for the rest of their lives. And the second piece of the equation is that women, the amount of women in the workforce, or in this case, quite frankly, two-income families, now it could be the man in that other role, is starting actually to decline. So we can't grow at 50% more women or men to the working force because we're already at 75.
And in fact, it's not going to go up.
It's not going to go up. It's got to go either stay the same or go down. So when you couple those two together, we have to get back to an expectation where housing prices over the long haul are directly tied to the rate of inflation, which means what buying a house does is freeze your housing cost in terms of a percent of your income or on real dollars, but it's not something that's going to make you wealthy.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, and I'm going to throw one more factor in there that I saw, especially in the mid-90s on, which is basically about the time that I got in the mortgage industry. And one of the things that I saw driving up the size of the house people could buy was the availability of these loan products that could get anybody into a house with very little money. They could afford more than what they really could get into, and it drove the prices up, especially in California. When you look at what happened on the coast, you pretty much had to get those negative amortizing option arms, where it's a monthly adjustable that's based on the fact that housing will always go up.
Correct.
Because there's no way it could ever go down in value because it's just always has.
It always has.
Right. Yeah. And I'd see somebody, you know, my question then was, okay, well, how much do you make on a normal job? Like, does a nurse, instead of making 50,000? Are they making 100, 200,000 as a nurse? The answer was no.
No.
It was the only way a normal person out there could even afford a house.
That's correct.
And that's when it really had gotten out of reach, that it, you know, it appreciated too fast.
Well, and that's why, you know, people that in the housing industry that, you know, want the, that market to get back to the good old days of 2002, 2005, 2006. Number one, we don't want that. And number two, with the credit standards that are in place now, there's no way that's going to happen. And that's good. We do not want a housing market that's as strong as a lot of the housing industry economists keep saying we need it. We need a housing market that looks a lot like what it is today, that we can sustain over a period of time. And if, in fact, I'm right that the economy of today is similar to the 90s, that allows us to have an 8 to 10-year period between the recession and the next recession, which means we've got another 3 or 4 or 5 years of good economic growth ahead of us. That's good news for everybody.
Okay, so let's shift the conversation to risk. What do you think the biggest risks are right now for our economy?
I think there's a couple. China is always a challenge because nobody really understands what's going on in China. I mean, in China, they have literally – there's a city in China that has been built that would house the entire population of St. Louis that's totally empty.
Right.
So,
I've talked about that on our show, is that we think our real estate meltdown was bad in the U.S. The one in China is just going to dwarf it.
Now, having said that, China's still economy is still growing. It's not growing 10 to 15% a year. It's growing 5 to 8. Still the fastest growing economy in the world. It's the biggest economy. It's going to be the biggest economy in the world at some point. But China's a risk because we don't really understand it. A second risk, I believe, is I'm not 100% convinced that the European debt crisis is fixed. They seem to have done some good things there, but I don't think we've really thought through the longer-term implications of those things. And I think the greatest long-term risk is that particularly the situation in Europe and China, if they those combined could cause us to go into an economic slowdown, a worldwide slowdown. And the long-term risk that I'm most afraid of and I do not know how to deal with is if we end up not with no inflation but actually have deflation. Or disinflation.
Yeah, and that's an interesting topic because I don't think that the normal person really understands deflation enough to be scared of it like they should be. Because, you know, everybody when the Fed wants inflation to go up about 3% a year, that's a good number, and we want that to go up because we want wages to continue to go up. You don't want it to go down because you're not going to get out of it.
Well,
ask Japan.
And a simple example, you know, let's say you have a $1,000 mortgage payment. If we have deflation, your income's going to go down over the next 2 or 3 years by 10%, and your mortgage payment's still going to be $1,000. So what happens is more and more your income has to go to the basic things. And the debt payments you have are fixed. If you have, in some cases, they may in fact go up. So it's a very, very destructive thing for an economy. And once you get in deflation, it's very hard to get out. Japan has been in a deflationary, essentially deflationary economy since 1990. And when I was
That's
in Japan,
a
long time. And I was in China about 10 years ago, and basically everybody over there is just worn out. I remember talking to one gentleman. He says, I work just as hard or harder every year, and I make less money. And that, right. That long-term is a very, very psychologically depressing type of world to live in.
Well, and we definitely have watched our standard of living in the U.S. start to go down, and it's probably going to continue to go down realistically.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Unfortunately, it's not, and there are changes that could be made that could prevent that, but they're not going to be. There's no way.
No, and I think our economy is going to start looking more and more like South America, where you have a very elite, wealthy class and a bigger and bigger class that's relatively poor, and it's shrinking middle class, and that's not really good for the economy long term.
Well, and that's always a complaint about the one percenters, especially for the leftist movement, always has a complaint about that, and I don't know that it's ever going to be much different than that. Unfortunately, but it's that problem may continue to get worse.
Yeah, and quite frankly, that one's beyond me to solve. But I don't think the general direction of the policies that have been implemented in the last 10 to 15 years, and I'm not just talking about during the Obama administration, but really going back in this century, they have not been conducive to long-term growth of the middle class.
Okay, so one question for you. We have a couple minutes left. There's a lot of movement to take minimum wage, basically double it, take it up to $15 an hour. What's the end result if that ended up happening?
Well, interestingly enough, unlike most business people, I don't think that's the dumbest idea I ever heard, because it would force employers to pay those lower wage workers who really have value more, and it would be a discouragement for them having low paid workers who really don't want to work employed. So I don't think the impact on the economy would be as negative as people think. What would happen is we'd have a lot higher unemployment among teens and among uneducated people. But I do not think it would be an economic disaster.
So do you think that people at a McDonald's deserve $15 an hour?
If McDonald's had to pay $15 an hour, they would not be able to tolerate the marginal employees that they have. And if you walk into a McDonald's at 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon, in many cases, it doesn't take 2 minutes to stand there and realize that 20% of the people they don't need to be there. So, and I've always been a proponent of having less people and paying them more, because I think at the end of the day, you get more quality. So from that standpoint, increasing the minimum wage, I think, would actually help. $15 an hour is probably too high, but I do think a number somewhere in the $11, $12 an hour range would not be hard on the economy. And I think in terms of people getting a better understanding that when you hire a worker, it needs somebody who produces something, that would be good.
Couldn't you do that without having to raise minimum wage? Couldn't, you know, if you had the $7.50 job that you've been paying minimum wage to, couldn't you go ahead and pay $12 to get a better person without having to raise the minimum wage?
Some businesses do. Unfortunately, most business owners, and this is based on working for 25 years experience, still have a mindset that the best way to make money is to pay low-level employees as little as possible and hope you get something instead of paying a little bit more and having a higher quality. I work with my clients. Basically, what I tell my clients is we want to find out who the valuable employees are and pay them well so they stay with us, and we want to get rid of the marginal employees.
Very good. Well, this is great information. Appreciate you taking your time out to come, you know, sit with us in the studio and share it. I think there's going to be people that are going to agree. There's going to be people that are going to disagree. Some of these are lightning rod topics, but I love the fact that we're at least approaching them. So, Bill, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bill Baer from Lighthouse Growth Resources. I'm going to make sure, Bill, that all your information is on our website at doughaldeman.com. That's doughaldeman.com. Look for Bill Baer, and then also you can visit billbaer.net. Sign up for Bill's blog. You're going to love it. You'll get a weekly email that's going to give you a summary of what he's writing about for the week. So, great information. So, Bill, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to everybody for tuning in. We appreciate it. We will see you next Sunday at 4 p.m., where becoming a financial juggernaut is as simple as listening every Sunday, modeling the advice of the experts, and implementing your personal plan. See you next week.